Chapter 1. She observed him from her chosen cover, as she'd done twice before. The first two times he'd been chopping wood, but today, after a heavy snowfall appropriate for the middle of December, he was shoveling the sidewalk. Today was the day she'd take him. Heart in her mouth, she watched as he cleared the snow with carefully controlled violence. Every movement was exactly the same as the one before. Each slide of the shovel was strictly parallel to previous marks, and in his fierce control, she saw his rage, tamped and contained by will alone, like a pipe bomb. Flattening herself and breathing lightly so he wouldn't see her, she considered how she would do it. From behind, she thought, as fast as possible, to give him no time to react. One quick movement and it would all be over. If she didn't lose her courage, as she had the first two times. Something told her that it had to be today, that she wouldn't get a fourth opportunity. He was wary and disciplined, and if he hadn't been so angry, surely his senses, werewolf sharp, would have discovered her hiding place in the snow beneath the fir trees lining his front yard. She shook with the stress of what she planned. Ambush. Weak and cowardly, but it was the only way she could take him. And it needed to be done, because it was only a matter of time before he lost the control that kept him shoveling to a steady beat, while the wolf raged inside him. And when his control failed, people would die. Dangerous. He could be so fast. If she screwed this up, he could kill her. She had to trust that her own werewolf reflexes were up to this. It needed to be done. Resolution gave her strength. It would be today. Charles heard the SUV, but he didn't look up. He turned off his cell and continued to ignore the cool voice of his father in his head until it went away. There was no one who lived near him on the snow-packed mountain road, so the SUV was just the next step in his father's determination to make him toe the line. "Hey, Chief!" It was a new wolf, Robert, sent here to the Aspen Creek pack by his own alpha because of his lack of control. Sometimes the Maroc could help. Other times, he just had to clean up the mess. If Robert couldn't learn discipline, it would probably be Charles's job to dispose of him. If Robert didn't learn manners, the disposal job wouldn't bother Charles as much as it should. That Bran had sent Robert to deliver his message told Charles just how furious his Da was. "Chief!" The man didn't even bother getting out of the car. There weren't many people Charles extended the privilege of calling him anything but his given name. And this pup wasn't one of them. Charles stopped shoveling and looked at the other wolf. Let him see just what he was messing with. The man lost his grin, paled, and dropped his eyes instantly, his heartbeat making the big blood vessel in his neck throb with sudden fear. Charles felt petty, and he resented it, resented his pettiness and the roiling anger that caused it. Inside him, Brother Wolf smelled Robert's weakness and liked it. The stress of defying the Maroc, his alpha, had left Brother Wolf wanting blood. Robert's would do. Charles didn't say anything. Let the fool work for it. He lowered his eyelids and watched the man squirm some more. The scent of his fear pleased Brother Wolf and made Charles feel a little sick at the same time. Usually he and Brother Wolf were in better harmony. Or maybe the real problem was that he wanted to kill someone too.
"The Maroc wants to see you."
Charles waited a full minute, knowing how long that time would seem to his father's message boy.
"That's it?"
"Yes, sir."
That "sir" was a far cry from "hey, chief."
"Tell him I'll come after my walk is cleared."
And he went back to work. After a few scrapes of his shovel, he heard the SUV turn around in the narrow road. The vehicle spun out, then grabbed traction and headed back to the Maroc's, fishtailing with Robert's urgent desire to get away. Brother Wolf was smugly satisfied. Charles tried not to be. Charles knew he shouldn't bait his father by defying his orders, especially not in front of a wolf who needed guidance, as Robert did. But Charles needed the time. He had to be in better control of himself before he faced the Merrock again. He needed real control that would allow him to lay out his argument logically and explain why the Merrock was wrong-headed, instead of simply bashing heads with him, the way they had the last four times Charles had spoken to him. Not for the first time he wished for a more facile tongue. His brother could sometimes change the Merrock's mind, but he never had. This time, Charles knew his father was wrong. And now he'd worked himself up into a fine mood. He focused on the snow and took a deep breath of cold air. And something heavy landed on his shoulders, dropping him face down in the snow. Sharp teeth and a warm mouth touched his neck and were gone as quickly as the weight that had dropped him. Without moving, he opened his eyes to slits, and from the corner of his eye, he glanced at the sky-eyed black wolf facing him warily, with a tail that waved tentatively, and paws that danced in the snow, claws extending and retracting like a cat's, with nervous excitement. And it was as though something clicked inside Brother Wolf, turning off the fierce anger that had been churning in Charles's gut for the past couple of weeks. The relief of that was enough to drop his head back into the snow. Only with her, only ever with her, did Brother Wolf settle down wholly. And a few weeks were not enough time to get used to the miracle of it, or to keep him from being too stupid to ask for her help. Which was why she'd planned this ambush, of course. When he was up to it, he'd explained to her how dangerous it was for her to attack him without warning. Though Brother Wolf had apparently known exactly who it was who'd attacked, he'd let them be taken down in the snow. The cold felt good against his face. The frozen stuff squeaked under her paws, and she made an anxious sound, proof that she hadn't noticed when he'd looked at her. Her nose was cold as it touched his ear, and he steeled himself not to react. Playing dead with his face buried in the snow, his smile was free to grow. The cold nose retreated, and he waited for it to come back within reach, his body limp and lifeless. She pawed at him, and he let his body rock, but when she nipped his backside, he couldn't help but jerk away with a sharp sound. Faking dead was useless after that, so he rolled over and rose to a crouch. She got out of reach quickly and turned back to look at him. He knew that she couldn't read anything in his face. He knew it. He had too much practice controlling all of his expressions. But she saw something that had her dropping her front half down to a crouch and loosening her lower jaw in a wolfish grin, a universal invitation to play. He rolled forward, and she took off with a yip of excitement. They wrestled all over the front yard, making a mess of his carefully tended walk and turning the pristine snow into a battleground of foot and body prints. He stayed human to even the odds because Brother Wolf outweighed her by 60 or 80 pounds, and his human form was almost her weight. She didn't use her claws or teeth against his vulnerable skin. He laughed at her mock growls when she got him down and went for his stomach, then laughed again at the icy nose she shoved under his coat and shirt, more ticklish than any fingers in the sensitive spots on the sides of his belly. He was careful never to pin her down, never to hurt her even by accident. That she'd risk this was a statement of trust that warmed him immensely. But he never let Brother Wolf forget that she didn't know them well, and had more reason than most to fear him and what he was, male and dominant and wolf. He heard the car drive up. He could have stopped their play, but Brother Wolf had no desire to take up a real battle yet. So he grabbed her hind foot and tugged it as he rolled out of reach of gleaming fangs. And he ignored the rich scent of his father's anger, a scent that faded abruptly. Anna was oblivious to his father's presence. Bran could do that, fade into the shadows as if he were just another man and not the Merrock. All of her attention was on Charles. and it made Brother Wolf preen that even the Merrock was second to them in her attentions. It worried the man, because untrained to use her wolf senses, someday she might not notice some danger that would get her killed. Brother Wolf was sure that they could protect her and shook off Charles's worry, dragging him back into the joy of play. He heard his father sigh and strip out of his clothing as Anna made a run for it and Charles chased her all the way around the house. She used the trees in the back as barriers to keep him at bay when he got too close. Her four clawed feet gave her more traction than his boots did, and she could get around the trees faster. At last, he chased her out of the trees, and she bolted back around the house with him hot on her trail. She rounded the corner to the front yard and froze at the sight of his father in wolf shape, waiting for them. It was all Charles could do to not keep going through her like a running back. As it was, he took her legs right out from under her as he changed his run into a slide. Before he could check to see if she was okay, a silver missile was on him, and the whole fight changed abruptly. Charles had been mostly in control of the action when it was just he and Anna, but with the addition of his father, he was forced to an earnest application of muscle, speed, and brain to keep the two wolves, black and silver, from making him eat snow. At last, he lay flat on his back, with Anna on his legs and his father's fangs touching the sides of his throat in mock threat. "Okay," he said, relaxing his body in surrender. "Okay. I give up." The words were more than just an end to play. He'd tried, but in the end, the Alpha's word was law. Whatever followed would follow. So he submitted as easily as any pup in the pack to his father's dominance. The Merrock lifted his head and removed himself from Charles's chest. He sneezed and shook off snow as Charles sat up and pulled his legs out from under Anna. "Thanks," he told her, and she gave him a happy grin. He gathered up the clothes from the hood of his father's car and opened the door to the house. Anna bounced into the living room and trotted down the hall to the bedroom. He tossed his father's clothes into the bathroom, and when his father followed them, shut the door behind the white-tipped tail. He had hot chocolate and soup ready when his father emerged, his face flushed with the effort of the change, his eyes hazel and human once more. He and his Da didn't look much alike. Charles took after his Salish mother, and Bran was Welsh through and through, with sandy hair and prominent features that usually wore a deceptively earnest expression, which was currently nowhere in evidence. Despite the play, Bran didn't look particularly happy. Charles didn't bother trying to talk. He had nothing to say anyway. His grandfather had often told him that he tried too hard to move trees when a wiser man would walk around them. His grandfather had been a medicine man and liked to speak in metaphors. He had usually been right. He handed his Da a cup of hot chocolate.
"Your wife called me last night," Bran's voice was gruff.
"Ah," he hadn't known that. Anna must have done it while he'd been out trying to outrun his frustrations.
"She told me I wasn't hearing what you were saying," his Da said. "I told her that I heard you tell me quite clearly that I was an idiot for going to Seattle to meet with the European delegation, as did most of the rest of the pack."
"Tactful, that's me," thought Charles, who decided sipping his cocoa was better than opening his mouth. "And I asked him if you were in the habit of arguing with him without a good reason," said Anna breezily as she slipped by his father and brushed against Charles. She was wearing his favorite brown sweater. On her, it hung halfway down her thighs and buried her shape in cocoa-colored wool. Brother Wolf liked it when she wore his clothes. She should have looked like a refugee, but somehow she didn't. The color turned her skin to porcelain and brought out rich highlights in her light brown hair. It also emphasized her freckles, which he adored. She hopped up on the counter and purred happily as she snagged the cocoa he'd made for her.
"And then she hung up," said his father in disgruntled tones.
"Hmm," said Anna. Charles couldn't tell if she was responding to the hot chocolate or his father.
"And she refused to pick up the phone when I called back."
His father wasn't pleased. Not so comfortable having someone around who doesn't instantly obey you, old man, Charles thought, just as his father met his eye. Bran's sudden laugh told Charles that his Da wasn't really upset. Frustrating, Charles ventured. He yelled at me, Anna said serenely, tapping her forehead. The Merrok could speak to any of his wolves mind to mind, though he couldn't read their thoughts, no matter how much it felt like that was what he was doing. He was just damnably good at reading people. I ignored him, and he went away eventually.
No fun fighting someone who doesn't fight back, Charles said.
Without someone to argue with, I knew he'd have to think about what I said, Anna told them smugly. If only to come up with the right words to squelch me the next time he talked to me. She hadn't reached even a quarter of a century yet. They hadn't been mated a full month. And she was already arranging them all to suit herself. Brother Wolf was pleased with the mate he'd found for them. Charles set down his cup and folded his arms over his chest. He knew he looked intimidating. That was his intention. But when Anna leaned away from him just a little, he dropped his arms and hooked his thumbs in his jeans and made his shoulders relax. And his voice was gentler than he'd meant it to be. Manipulating Bran has a tendency to backfire, he told her. I'd recommend against it. But his father rubbed his mouth and sighed loudly.
So, said his father, why is it that you think it would be disastrous for me to go to Seattle?
Charles rounded on his father, his resolve to quit fighting Bran on his decision to go to Seattle all but forgotten. The Beast is coming, and you ask me that?
Who?
Anna asked.
Jean Chastel, the Beast of Gévaudan, Charles told her. He likes to eat his prey, and his prey is mostly human.
He stopped that, Bran said coolly.
Please, Charles snapped. Don't mouth something you don't believe to me. It smells perilously close to a lie. The Beast was forced to stop killing openly, but a tiger doesn't change his stripes. He's still doing it. You know it as well as I do. He could have pointed out other things. Jean had a taste for human flesh. The younger, the better. But Anna had already experienced what happened when a wolf turned monstrous. He didn't want to be the one to tell her that there were worse beasts out there than her former alpha and his mate. His father knew what Jean Chastel was. Bran conceded the point.
Yes, almost certainly he is. But I'm not a helpless human. He won't kill me.
He looked at Charles narrowly.
Which you know. So why do you think it will be dangerous?
He was right. Take the Beast out of the picture, and it still made him ill to think of his father going. The Beast was the most obvious, provable danger.
I just know, Charles said finally. But it is your decision to make.
His gut clenched in anticipation of just how bad it was going to be.
You still don't have a logical reason.
No. Charles forced his body to accept his defeat and kept his eyes on the floor. His Da looked out the little window where the mountains lay draped in winter white.
Your mother did that, he said. She'd make a statement without any real support at all. And I was supposed to just take her word for it.
Anna was looking at his Da with bright expectancy. Bran smiled at her, then raised his cup toward the mountains.
I learned the hard way, but she was usually right. Frustrating doesn't come close to covering it. So, he said, turning his attention back to Charles, they're on their way already. I can't cancel it now, and it needs to be done. Announcing to the real world that there are werewolves among them will affect the European wolves as much, if not more, than it does us. They deserve their chance to be heard and told why we are doing it. It should come from me, but you would be an acceptable substitute. It will cause some offense, though, and you will have to deal with that.
Relief flooded Charles with an abruptness that had him leaning against the countertop in sudden weakness, as the all-consuming sense of absolute and utter disaster slid away and left him whole. Charles looked at his mate.
My grandfather would have loved to have met you, he told her huskily. He would have called you, she moves trees out of his path.
She looked lost, but his da laughed. He'd known the old man, too. He called me He Who Must Run Into Trees, Charles explained, and in a spirit of honesty, a need for his mate to know who he was, he continued, or sometimes, Running Eagle.
Running Eagle?
Anna puzzled it over, frowning at him.
What's wrong with that?
Too stupid to fly,
murmured his father with a little smile.
That old man had a wicked tongue, wicked and clever, so it stuck until he dinged you with your next offense.
He tilted his head at Charles.
But you were a lot younger then, and I'm not so solid an object as a tree. You'd feel better if you...
Anna cleared her throat pointedly. His da smiled at her.
If you and Anna go instead?
Yes. Charles paused because there was something more, but the house was too busy with modern things for the spirits to talk to him clearly. Usually, that was a good thing. When they got too demanding, he sometimes retreated to his office, where the computers and electronics kept them out entirely. Still, there was something in him that breathed easier now that his father had agreed not to go.
Not safe, but better.
When do you want us in Seattle?
Chapter 2.
I love Seattle. Chrissy folded her arms around herself and spun in a circle. She looked up with a practiced little girl grin, and her lover smiled down at her. He reached out and tucked a gold curl behind her ear.
Shall we move here, princess? I could get you a condo that looks over the water.
She thought about it and finally shook her head. I'd miss New York, you know I would. No place as shopping like New York.
All right, he said, his voice an indulgent purr. But we can come here to play now and again, if you like it.
Chrissy tilted her head and caught the rain in her mouth, a quick snap like a bat taking a bug out of the sky.
Can we play now?
Work before play, said Hannah, the spoil sport. She'd been Ivan's playmate before Chrissy. Chrissy had taken her place in his bed and in his heart, and it made Hannah pissy.
Ivan, Chrissy coaxed, putting a hand on either side of his shirt and tugging him down so she could lick his lips. Can't we go play? We don't have to work tonight, do we?
He let her take his mouth, and when he raised his head, his eyes were hot.
Anna, take the others to our hotel and contact our employer. Chrissy and I will be there in a few hours.
It was raining again, but Jody had been raised in Eugene, where it only rained once a year, from January to December. Besides, he was a Pisces. Water was his element. He raised his face and let the rain wash down it. Practice had run a little late, and the sun had set before he'd gotten out. The music had been good tonight. They'd all felt it. He pulled the sticks out of his back pocket and beat the air in a rhythm only he could hear. There was something he should change in that last measure. He took the shortcut to his apartment, a dim little street barely wide enough for a car and a half. It wasn't late, but there was no one around except for an older man and a girl who looked about 16. They were both drenched and hurried toward him.
Excuse me, said the man. We're visiting and seem to have gotten turned around. Do you know where the nearest restaurant is?
The coat he wore was expensive. Wool, Jody thought. And he had a bright gold watch on his wrist that looked like it cost a bundle. The girl, as they got closer, he was pretty sure that there was more than a generation between the old gent and the girl. Maybe she was his granddaughter. Was wearing 4-inch heels that made her feet look tiny. She caught him looking and enjoyed his admiration. He couldn't help but smile back. She put her hand on his wrist and said,
"We need to find some food."
And her smile widened a little more, and he saw fangs. Strange, he thought. She didn't look like she belonged in the groups his ex-girlfriend had hung out with, where they all wore fangs and played that stupid game, not D&D, which was cool, something with vampires. This girl wore a ponytail and looked more like Britney Spears than Vampirella. Her shoes were hot pink, and there wasn't a piece of her clothing that was black.
He didn't like it that his throat tightened in fear because she was wearing acrylic fangs.
"There's a place a few blocks away," he told her, twisting his wrist gently to get her to let go. "Serves Italian food. They have a great red sauce."
She licked her lips and didn't let go of his wrist.
"I love red sauce."
"Look," he said, jerking his wrist free.
"Cut it out. That's not funny."
"No," breathed the man,
who had somehow gotten behind him while Jody had been talking to the girl.
"Not funny at all."
And there was a sharp pain in his neck.
"Where is someplace private?"
the old man asked after a little while.
"Someplace we might play together for a while without anyone seeing us."
And Jody led his new friends a few miles away to a place on the sound where he knew no one would come.
"Good," said the man. "Very good."
The girl closed her eyes and smiled.
"The traffic will drown out the screams."
The man leaned over and put his mouth to Jody's ear.
"You can be scared now."
Jody was scared for a very, very long time before they threw him into the water for the fish.
"The rocks will keep him underwater until they won't be able to tell how he died," said Ivan.
"I still think we should have left him naked, hanging from a tree like that girl in Syracuse."
Ivan rubbed the top of her head.
"Dear child," he said,
and sighed.
"That was a special case. She was a message to her father. This one was just play. And if we let the silly humans know we killed him, it would interfere with business."
She looked at the bloody drumsticks and sighed, tossing them in after the body.
"And nothing interferes with business."
"Business keeps a roof over our heads and lets us travel when we want to," Ivan told her. "You need to wash your face, princess, and put your clothes back on."
A great mountain peak broke through the white mist and ruled in awesome splendor over the soft sky, and Anna held her breath. Mount Rainier, she thought, though her geography of the Cascades was shaky. There were mountains spread out below them, but this one was orders of magnitude larger than the lowly ripples in the land below it. Gradually, other great peaks revealed themselves in the distance, drowning in clouds.
"Hey, Charles?"
The mountains were on Charles's side of the plane. Anna leaned as far toward him as she could without touching him. He was flying the plane, and she didn't want to distract him.
"Yes?"
They were both wearing headsets that protected their sensitive ears from the noise of the engine and mic'd their voices to each other. In her headphone, his voice was low enough to make the speaker in her ear buzz, even though it was turned to the lowest setting.
"Just how many planes does the pack have?"
This was the second she'd been in.
"Just the Learjet," he told her. "If you lean any farther, you're going to strangle yourself. This Cessna is mine."
He owned a plane? Just when she was starting to think she knew him, something else would come up. She knew that he handled the pack finances, and that their pack was not in any danger of being penniless any time soon. She knew that he himself was financially stable, though they hadn't really talked about it much. Owning a plane was a whole different category of financially stable. Like Mount Rainier was a whole different category of mountain from the hills she'd known in Illinois.
"Aren't we on pack business?" she asked. "Why did we take this one?"
"The jet needs 5,000 feet to land," he said. "That means Boeing Field or SeaTac, and I don't want the government to be following us around all week."
"The government follows you?"
She had a sudden picture of Charles strolling along with dark-suited men creeping behind him, trying to stay out of sight and failing with cartoonish exaggeration. He nodded.
"We may be a secret from the rest of the world, but the wrong people know who we are."
And that was why the Merrock had decided it was time to bring the werewolves out to the public.
"So the wrong people are following you?"
He smiled wolfishly.
"Only when I want them to."
She considered that smile and decided she liked it on him.
"So where are we landing?"
"At an airstrip maintained by the Emerald City Pack. It's about 30 miles from Seattle."
The plane bounced, dropping fast and tickling her stomach. She gripped her armrests and laughed as Charles brought the plane back to level. I really like flying.
He dipped his head and looked at her over the top of his dark lenses for a moment. Then his mouth quirked up, and he turned his attention back to his instrument panel. The plane tilted to the left. Anna waited for him to right it, but they just kept tilting, all the way upside down, and continued smoothly over until they were back upright again. Over her laughter, he said,
This plane isn't rated for aerobatics, but a roll is only a 1G maneuver.
He tilted the plane over the other way and said,
Properly done.
And then he danced the plane through the sky. She was breathless, and her diaphragm ached from laughing by the time the plane settled back on level flight. She glanced at Charles, who wasn't even smiling. He might have just as well been flying patterns over a grain field.
He hated planes just as he hated most modern technology. He'd told her so, but he owned one. And by golly, he knew how to fly it. When he drove his truck, he was cautious and controlled. So why had he decided to play Barnstormer in the Cessna? Was he just entertaining her, or was he enjoying himself? A woman should know more about her mate. When the mate bond had first settled in, she'd believed she would. But her initial ability to feel him had faded, buried under his self-control and her defenses. She could feel the bond between them, strong and shining and impenetrable. She wondered if it felt the same to him, or if he could read her through it whenever he chose.
This is Station Air November 1883 Victor requesting permission to land, he said,
and it took her a moment to realize he was talking to someone other than her.
Go ahead, sir. I mean, go ahead, 83 Victor, said a stranger's voice. Welcome to Emerald City Pack territory, sir.
Charles dropped them abruptly through the scattered clouds, past white-coated mountains, to the soft green valley below. Before she realized there was a landing strip, the wheels touched down with a gentle bump. The place where they landed looked nearly as remote as Aspen Creek. Though there was snow 100 feet or so up the foothills, down where they had landed it was as green as if it were summer. Greener. Except for the landing field and a hangar, the land was awash in trees and bushes. People jogged up to the plane from the hangar as Charles pulled his headset off and unbuckled. He withdrew from her, thinning the bond between them painfully. If he'd warned her beforehand, she would have kept quiet. 3 years in her first pack had given her power over her pain. It was surprise that forced the whine out of her throat. Charles pulled his sunglasses off his face and looked at her with a frown. Sudden comprehension widened his eyes. I never thought, he turned his head and said, not to her, All right, all right, and the painful collapse of their bond ceased. Wolf-eyed, he leaned toward her and touched her face. I'm sorry, he told her. I didn't mean to shut you out. I just... He stopped, apparently at a loss for words.
Donning your armor? She suggested. It's okay, I just... wasn't expecting it. Do what you have to.
But he didn't. Instead, he said, looking out at the approaching men, These are not the enemy. Not this time, anyway. He was out of his seat before she could say anything. And what would I have said? He closed himself up so that he could kill if he had to, so that he wouldn't like any of them too much, so he wouldn't hesitate in carrying out whatever had to be done. She did know something about her mate, after all. She climbed out behind him, following him out of the plane and into the presence of strange wolves, still trying to decide if it should reassure her or worry her.
Glad you made it in, sir, said the one who was in charge. It still freaked her out sometimes, how she could tell who was in charge by the subtle cues of body motion and position. Real people, normal humans, didn't need to know who was first and who was last. We were following you on our radar, and Jim here was worried you might have had some trouble because your speed seemed a little erratic.
Charles gave them a neutral face, and Anna wondered what his acrobatics had looked like on radar.
No trouble, he said.
The other wolf cleared his throat and dropped his gaze.
Good. I'm Ian Garner of the Emerald City Pack, and I'm to help you in any way that I can.
As Charles and the other wolves unloaded the luggage and discussed how the plane was to be cared for and stored, Anna stood a little apart. She wasn't as nervous with the strangers as she expected to be, and it took her a minute to pinpoint why. Ian was middle of the pack and leader here, so this group was not the Alpha's top tier of wolves, nowhere near the most dominant. They were wolves who wouldn't spark a dominant male's instinct to put them in their places. Angus Hopper, the Emerald City Pack Alpha, was a smart man. Not that he had to worry about Charles's control, but playing it safe was always a smart move. Angus wouldn't have done it because strange dominant males still scared Anna, but part of her was grateful nonetheless. There would be enough dominant males to drown in later when the meetings took place. The wolves coming from Europe each ruled their own territories. Some of them had been in power for centuries. No one would hurt her, not while she was with Charles, she knew it, but her fear of male wolves had taken a few years to beat into her, and would take more than a month or two to free herself from. "They'll take care of the airplane," said Ian. He picked up the nearest piece of luggage, and with a dropped shoulder and a deferential swing of his head instead of words, invited them to follow him up a stone pathway through the trees. Charles took his own suitcase and waited for Anna to precede him. Once he had them moving, the Emerald City Wolf started talking in a rapid, all-business voice that might have masked his anxiety from someone who was purely human. Charles did that to people, even in his own pack, and she didn't think even his father knew how much it bothered him. "Angus is at work," the wolf said. "He says you're to have free access to the house." Anna remembered getting a glimpse of a house as they landed, but from the ground it was well hidden by the trees. That must be where they were headed toward. "You're welcome to anything any of us have, but the pack itself has a newish Land Cruiser and a Corolla that has seen better days. Angus says you can use his BMW if you'd rather."
"We'll take the Corolla," Charles told him. "And we're staying in a hotel downtown. This is too far for an easy commute to the meeting place."
"He thought you would feel that way. Angus invites you to stay with him at his condo in the city."
"Not necessary," said Charles.
Anna wasn't sure he noticed the other man's mouth flatten. More probably, he just didn't care. The Emerald City Pack was hosting the meeting, and for Charles to refuse housing might look like he was not acknowledging them as allies. Charles preferred to be independent, separate from the people he might be called upon to kill. Charles was his father's assassin and justice dealer, and that grim responsibility affected everything he did. He didn't go out of his way to make friends among the werewolves, not even in his own pack. He would feel more comfortable on his own. That didn't mean that Anna couldn't smooth things over.
"We appreciate the offer," Anna told Ian, "but we're newly mated and..."
It didn't require any effort on her part to blush as her voice trailed off, and whatever offense he'd felt was overshadowed by interest.
"So it's true," Ian glanced at Charles, then quickly away. "I had heard that."
"Shocking, I know," murmured Charles.
The other wolf stiffened and gave Charles a worried look, too wary of Charles to hear the humor.
"He's a terrible tease," she told Ian, trying to help.
The Emerald City wolf's face loosened in utter disbelief. Charles saw it and grinned at her. It was too bad Ian didn't see her mate's expression, but Charles's usual in-public granite facade was back before the other wolf glanced his way.
"Right," Ian said. He cleared his throat and changed the subject. "Well, Angus asked me to tell you that the only people we're waiting for are the Russians and the French. He thought you might also be interested to know that the British Alpha came alone with his mate. We'll know when the Russians get here. They're staying in the apartment Angus's company owns."
"Angus's company?" asked Anna. They'd packed in a hurry, and she hadn't asked him much about what they'd actually be doing here.
"Angus runs a high-tech company," Charles explained. "They put together programs to keep other companies running. We'll be using his facilities this week. He's given his staff an early vacation for Christmas."
He looked at Ian.
"I'd wager the French wolves have arrived already. Chastel will want to check out his hunting grounds before the prey arrives."
"They haven't checked into the hotel they booked."
Charles shook his head.
"Tell Angus the Chastel would never stay in a hotel. Too public. He'll have rented a house. Something nice. He's here. Probably has been here for a week or two."
Charles claimed not to be good with people,
not to understand them, and maybe that was true, but he understood predators just fine. The trees thinned, and a house emerged from the forest. Like Bran's house, it had been built to take advantage of the natural topography, and the surrounding trees effectively hid a good deal of its bulk. Angus's company must be pretty lucrative. "Angus says it's the Frenchmen who will cause the most trouble," said Ian.
"Don't underestimate the Russians," Charles said. "But Angus is probably right. Jean is powerful, scary, and mad as a hatter. He likes killing, especially if his prey is weak and frightened. His life wouldn't hold up to the kind of scrutiny we're inviting by introducing ourselves to the world."
"Angus says that Jean Chastel will carry the vote because everyone else is scared of him?"
Charles smiled wolfishly, his eyes cold and clear.
"This is not a democracy. There is no vote, not on this. The Europeans have no say in whether or not we tell the world about ourselves. I'm here to listen to their concerns and decide what we can do to help them mitigate the impact of becoming public."
"That doesn't sound like what I've picked up from the European delegations who've arrived."
Ian was careful not to sound as if he were disagreeing with Charles.
"What about the Asian werewolves?" Anna asked. "Or African and Australian and South American?"
"They don't matter," Ian dismissed her question.
"They matter," said Charles softly. "They've been dealt with differently."
The sharp scent of fear coiled around Anna's nose. There had been a threat in Charles's voice when he thought the other wolf had overstepped himself, and Ian had clearly caught it. She gave Charles a frown.
"Stop terrorizing him. These are things I ought to have known. Tell me about the non-European werewolves."
Charles raised an eyebrow at her, but answered her readily enough.
"Werewolves are a European monster, and we've done pretty well here in this part of the New World, too. There are a few of us in Africa, and even fewer in Asia, where there are other monsters who don't like us very well. There are two packs in Australia, about 40 wolves. Both of their alphas have been informed of our plans, and neither voiced objections. Bran has also discussed his intentions with the South American wolves. They were less happy, but like the Europeans, they have no say in what my father does or does not do. Unlike the Europeans, they know it. We've offered them the same sorts of aid we're offering the Europeans, and they're happy with that. They were invited, but chose not to come."
The battered and abused Corolla was a four-speed stick shift with a touchy clutch, and it kept Anna's attention firmly on driving until they were on the interstate headed for the city.
"Okay," she said. "I need to understand more. I should have asked more questions, but this came up awfully fast. The British Alpha, by not bringing more wolves, is telling everyone he can handle anything anyone can send after him?"
Charles nodded.
"There's some bad blood between Arthur Madden, the British Alpha, and Angus."
He paused.
"Actually, I think there's some bad blood between Arthur and my father, too. If it looks like an issue, I'll call Da and see what it was about. Da says that Arthur's the only Alpha who will stand up to Chastel, and that's a good thing to have. We'll need every advantage we can get."
He sounded, not worried, intrigued. It was, Anna thought, going to be a different manner of fighting this week. Not fangs and blood, but a battle of wits. All those dominant wolves, most of the alphas in the same room, arguing. Maybe it wasn't going to be a different way of fighting. But for now, she was driving and had absolutely no idea where they were headed.
"Are we going to the hotel?"
"Yes,"
and he gave her directions. But as they turned off the highway and onto the streets of downtown Seattle, he said,
"Let's do something first. Why don't we go see Dana, the Fae, who's agreed to moderate this mess?"
And maybe, like his father, he'd been doing some mind reading.
"She's not just a stand-in for a UN ambassador, a graceful host to help Angus. She's the one who's going to keep this civilized and keep us from paying to have Angus's carpets cleaned of bloodstains. I have a gift to give her from my father to thank her for the help we are paying her a small fortune for."
"I didn't hear about the Fae."
Anna had never seen a Fae before, not one she knew was a Fae anyway. She felt a frisson of excitement and tightened her hands on the steering wheel.
Bran brought a Fae into werewolf business?
"It's necessary to have a neutral party to make sure the violence doesn't get out of hand."
Anna thought about the wolves she had known. The violence that had always gotten out of hand.
She tried to imagine someone who could put a stop to it. Bran, Charles, but they would have to do it with more violence. She can do that?
Yes, and more importantly, everyone knows it.
What kind of a Fae is she? Isn't Dana a German name? I thought most of the Fae were British, you know, Welsh, Irish, and Scots.
Most of the Fae we see in the U.S. are Northern European. Celtic, German, French, Cornish, English. Dana isn't her real name. This decade or so, she's been using the name Dana Shay, a variant of Dane She. A lot of the older Fae and some of the witches won't use their own names. Anything that belongs to them for such a long time develops power over them and can be used against them, the same way scraps of hair or fingernails can.
Do you know what her real name is, or what kind of Fae she is?
I don't know it. I don't think even Dawn knows it. Though she is a Grey Lord, one of the most powerful Fae. They rule the Fae sort of like Da does the Wolves.
He glanced at her.
If Da was a psychotic serial killer, maybe. I do know what kind of Fae she is, though. You meet her and talk to her a bit, then tell me what you think.
Anna gave a half-amused huff. What do I get if I'm right?
His eyes lightened with the wolf who lurked inside him, and the hunger in his gaze told her exactly what he meant when he said,
"The same thing you get if you're wrong."
She waited for the fear or even trepidation that thoughts of sex had usually brought to her. But it never came. Just a welcome, tickly feeling in her stomach. In less than a month's time, he'd made serious inroads on her problems in that area.
"Good," she told him.
He smiled at her and relaxed against his seat. Seattle highways had a lot more vertical variation than those in Chicago. The roads rose above water, tangled and burrowed under hills where houses sat unmoved by the thousands of cars that traveled beneath them. Over the smell of the cars was the scent of water and salt from the Puget Sound and various other saltwater lakes and ponds. The gray skies leaked here and there, not enough to turn the wipers on full, but too much to let the rain accumulate long. Following Charles's directions, she exited the highway and found herself tootling along a slower road in what could just as well have been a small town in Britain as a part of Seattle. It looked old, quaint, and beautiful, if a little self-conscious. On the water to her right was a series of docks with boats and houseboats, while on her left, narrow buildings covered the side of a hill that got progressively steeper as she drove. A huge silver bridge arched over the water and the road she was driving, soaring up to land on the top of a steep hill above. The name of the cross street that ran directly under the bridge had Anna pulling her foot off the gas so she could be sure that she was reading the sign correctly.
"Troll?"
"What?"
Charles had been looking toward the water, but he turned back to look at her.
"There's a street here called Troll?"
He smiled suddenly. "I'd forgotten about that. Why don't you follow it up the hill?"
She turned the little car up the road and thought for a moment the decision was a mistake because the little blue car strained to crawl up the hill, which was even steeper than it had looked from the bottom. The road was narrow and claustrophobic, with the bridge for roofing, its steel feet closing in from left and right. She was so busy worrying about driving that she didn't see it until they were quite close. The road they were on ended and teed into another road. The bridge overhead plowed into the top of the hill, and in the space between the road and the end of the bridge crouched a giant something. Without consulting Charles, she parked. Someone had sculpted a huge humanoid monster out of cement, rising from the sand. A troll for the bridge. Cement hair hung limply over one eye, while the other stared over Anna's head at the waterway at the bottom of the hill they'd just driven up. One of its hands, which rested on a real VW bug, was big enough to engulf the car. The bug's nose burrowed beneath the troll's beard, as if it sought refuge there. Anna got out of the car slowly and strolled across the road, Charles at her side. The statue had been attacked with chalk recently, and the bright pink and green colors only enhanced the oddity of the creature. Fingernails and the lines of knuckles had been drawn on the creature's hands. Pink and green chalk flowers followed the contours of the bug's fender, and on the back window, cement-covered glass, someone had written, "Just married." Peripherally, Anna sensed they were being watched.
Above the troll, in the notch where the bridge met the top of the hill, three or four street people observed them warily. One man set aside a newspaper he'd been reading and started down toward them. He was a little above average height, though he slumped until he appeared shorter. He wore a battered canvas duster that was liberally splattered with muck. Mismatched Nikes adorned his feet. The right shoe had a hole in the toe, and the left another along the edge of his heel, exposing the dirty, sockless foot inside. The jeans he wore were new and stiff, though as mucky as his duster. She caught glimpses of layers of shirts, a red flannel shirt over a yellow plaid button-up that almost obscured a graying white tee. Anna took note of the man, but with Charles at her side, the stranger wasn't a threat, and Anna was more interested in the troll. So she let Charles deal with him as she climbed up the back of the bug and onto the creature's arm, then higher still until she could rest her hand on his overlarge nose.
"Like my little troll, eh?" the stranger said to Charles, his voice rough, like that of a man who'd smoked a pack a day for years. He didn't smell like cigarettes, though. His scent, rising through the air to Anna's nose, was earthy and magical, sharp with a predator's musk.
"Was it a real one?"
Anna asked him, safe upon her perch, safe with Charles. The stranger looked up at her and laughed, exposing ragged, blackened teeth as sharp as he smelled.
"Well, now, it might be that the artist saw something, he oughter not have seen, Wolfkin."
He patted the cement arm she stood on, and she took a wary step back.
"Happened, though, he built me a friend. So we're all happy. Even the Grey Lord there, she thought it were funny. Didn't hardly hurt me at all for getting seen and not telling her."
The Fae could hide what they were, could look just like anyone else. But the hunger that shone in his eyes when he looked at her was as immortal as she was, and a lot older. Her wolf didn't like him, and Anna narrowed her eyes at him and let him hear her growl. He should know that she was not prey. He laughed again and slapped one thigh with a hand covered in a worn, fingerless glove.
"If and I forgot myself so bad as to take a bite,"
he snapped his teeth together, and in the darkness under the bridge she saw the spark when they struck.
"She'd chew me up and feed me them great octopuses that live round here, she would."
The thought seemed to amuse him.
"Though good meaty bit of wolf flesh might be worth it."
"Troll," said Charles. He had been having so much fun with Anna, he'd forgotten about the real threat. Reminded, he jerked around, crouched, and hissed. Charles took out one of the plain gold studs he wore in his ears and tossed it at the Fae, who caught it with inhumanly quick hands.
"Take your toll and go, old one," Charles said.
"Hey, Jer,"
came a worried and thin voice from above them.
"You don't go bothering them or the police'll have us out of here, you know they will."
The troll, in human guise, held the bit of gold up to his nose and smelled. His face twitched, and his eyes swirled with an eerie blue light before they settled down and became just eyes again.
"Toll,"
he said.
"Toll."
"Jerry?"
"No troubles, Bill,"
he called up to his, what, friends? His roommates, his bridge mates, who were more human than he.
"Just saying good afternoon."
He looked at Charles, and for a moment an oddly noble expression crossed his face, his back straightened, shoulders thrown back. In a clear, accentless voice he said,
"Word of advice for your payment. Don't trust the Fae."
He laughed again, devolving into the man who'd greeted them in the first place, and scrambled up the hill and under the bridge. Charles didn't say anything, but Anna slid off her perch and followed him back to the car.
"Are trolls really as big as that statue?"
she asked, belting herself in.
"I don't know,"
Charles answered, and smiled at the startled look she gave him.
"I don't know everything. I've never seen a troll in its true form."
She started the car.
"A toll is supposed to be for crossing his bridge. We didn't cross the bridge."
"But we were trespassing. It seemed appropriate."
"What about the advice he gave?"
He smiled again, his face lit with amusement.
You know what they say. Don't trust the Fae.
Okay. It was a common piece of advice, the first thing people said, and the main point of most stories about them. Especially when they tell us not to, I suppose. Where to now?
Back down the troll road. See those docks down there? Dana lives on a houseboat at the foot of the troll.
He'd only visited Dana at her home once before, but Charles had no trouble finding it again. It didn't exactly blend in. There were four docks. Three of them had a number of boats of various kinds secured to them. The fourth had only one.